Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Welcome to episode 28 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host as always. And today we have the pleasure of speaking with another Neil, who, by the way, spells his name the proper way, N-E-I-L, as do I, Neil Brown. Neil Brown is a solicitor, that's a lawyer, in the United Kingdom, in England, practicing in Newbury, about an hour west of London, as you'll hear. And he practices with his lovely wife, Sandra. They specialize in advising internet, telecom, technology, and healthcare businesses. And we're going to speak for a little while about the difference of how you go about getting a law degree in England versus opposed to the States here, and what kind of training you go through before you can open your own practice. There are some restrictions in England as to who can open a solo practice. So it's really interesting to compare and contrast the two systems. After that, we'll talk about his practice itself and how successful he and Sandra have been in developing this firm and what they see for the future there in Newbury. And we'll also chat a little bit about how it is practicing with a spouse. So without further delay, let's have a chat with Neil Brown. Neil Brown, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you very much for having me, Neil.
I'm thrilled that you're taking the time to join us here from all the way across the pond there in the UK. Tell us, where are you located exactly?
I'm located in Newbury, which is about an hour west of London.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about your practice and how you've gotten to the point where you are today.
Absolutely. It's dead simple. I'm in practice with my wife, and we're a specialist English law firm. We advise internet, telecoms, technology, healthcare startups and businesses. We came from a background of working for companies. I worked for a telecommunications company for about 10 years. My wife worked in-house as a lawyer for a pharmaceutical company. And we went from there. We loved working in the commercial world. We love advising businesses. And we decided we wanted to try and advise a broader range of businesses. Okay. A law firm seemed a logical next place to go.
Well, let's talk a little bit for our listeners, since you have the honor of being our first attorney on the show from outside the U.S. Tell us a little bit about how one goes about getting admitted to the practice in England. And we can contrast that with how that's done here in the States.
Sure. So if I understand things correctly, and I must confess that most of my knowledge about U.S. legal education comes from either a John Grisham novel or the film Legally Blonde.
Well, I think both are equally valid.
Well, I think the sense I get is that law tends to be a postgraduate thing in the U.S.
Correct.
In England and Wales, and perhaps other parts of the U.K. too, law as an undergraduate degree is common. And that's the route that I took. My undergraduate degree was law. We split our legal education into three stages. There's the academic stage of training, which is either that undergraduate law degree, or else you can do any undergraduate degree and a year's conversion course. And that was the route my wife took. When you've completed your academic stage, you move on to the vocational stages of training. And that's generally a 1 year or slightly shorter than 1 year practical course, again, taught at a college or a university. And then you have the practical training stage, which is either in-house in a company or at a law firm, where you spend 2 years doing a number of different areas of law in what's known as your training contract. And when you've completed your academic stage and your vocational stage and your training contract, at that point you become admitted as a solicitor and you're entitled to hold yourself out and practice as a solicitor.
Well, that's really interesting and really addresses a couple of issues that I think many attorneys here in the States would agree with me are potential shortcomings with the way it's approached here in the United States. So for us, it's a post, as you're quite correct, it's a postgraduate experience. Most people go to 4 years of undergrad school. They may actually then do another 2 or 3 years in a master's program in some cases, not necessarily in all cases, and then apply for law school, get admitted to law school. And it's usually a 3-year program if they go full time during the day, or 4 years if they go at night, and in some cases longer. And at the end of that process, there is the dreaded bar exam, all or nothing experience where you take the exam, and if you pass, you're then admitted to the practice of law. Now, from what I understand from what you just described, there's no single exam that one has to take through this process there in the UK?
That's right. The opportunities to fail are spread across the years of education rather than all being lumped at the end.
Yeah. Well, we have that too, but at the end, it's a make or break singular exam, the bar exam, which causes a lot of stress and consternation for sure. I like that you have this vocational practice, 1 year of a practical additional training, which supplements the academic curriculum and is sandwiched in between 2 years of practical training. Tell me a little bit about what you do during the vocational period.
It was a number of years ago since I did it, I'll be honest. But certainly what it was at the time was split between the mechanics of a legal practice and trying to take some of what you learned in your academic education to apply it in a more practical context. So rather than learning about property law, for example, you would look at conveyancing. Perhaps rather than studying company law from an academic perspective, you'd look at practical issues facing those advising directors of companies.
Okay.
But there are also very practical aspects within it, looking at how you do your accounts, the regulatory framework for law firms in the UK, in England and Wales, perhaps Scotland and Northern Ireland as well, has specific rules about solicitors' accounts. And so part of the vocational training is ensuring you understand those rules and you can go through and do your basic double entry bookkeeping, keep things up to date, practical legal research skills, that kind of thing. What it doesn't do, and what I think your podcast does a fantastic thing in helping to redress, is the real thinking behind running a law firm.
Okay.
And I think that there's a reason for that, and that's in England and Wales, is you cannot start your own law firm the moment you qualify as a solicitor.
Really?
You have to be at least 3 years qualified before you can run your own firm.
Well, that's interesting as well.
That's seen as a consumer protection measure, that you know that when you're hiring a solicitor, they will have been with another law firm or working in a company for at least 3 years before you hire them. They're not fresh out of law school, fresh out of their training.
Well, and it also sounds as if you've got, when you get to that point, you've had the 1 year of vocational training, the 2 years of practical training, and then 3 years on top of that. Yeah, well, it's a little more stringent than it is here in the States. For one of the points that I've made on the show and repeatedly is that with the downturn of the economy over the last 5 years, there's a lot of shrinkage in the job market, the legal job market. And so for many of the attorneys coming straight out of law school here in the U.S., their only opportunity to practice law may very well be to open their own solo practice. And so if they had a 3-year waiting period where they had to work for another firm, that would kill that in practical sense. But, it's different. The requirements have grown for a reason there in the UK, and it obviously it works very well. So
it's under consultation at the moment. There's a proposal to take it away, and it would look as if one option would be to enable practice as a solicitor on your own straight after you've completed your training contract.
So that's one.
Not sure which way it will go.
Yeah. So that's one of the considerations being thought of.
Yes, at the moment.
There was a time here in the States where you could sit for the bar exam. You didn't have to go to law school. And so there would be individuals who would work in a law firm as an intern. And I believe, my listeners can correct me if I'm wrong, that it was called reading for the law. You would actually read all about the practice of law and then take your chances at a law exam or a bar exam. So I'm not sure if that's permitted in any of the states. It's something that I probably should know for conversational purposes. I just don't happen to know that. I know in the states that I'm admitted to, I don't believe that's permitted. You have to go through an accredited law school and take the bar exam.
And I think that's reflected in where things are in England and Wales at the moment. You have to have your academic training, you have to have your vocational training, and then you have to have your training contract. There are some nuances, there are some extra obligations, it seems, in England and Wales, but the same idea of having that accredited training to get you across the line, it's not just a case of passing an exam, seems to be similar.
Well, tell us a little bit about your decision to open your own practice. What motivated that? How did that come about? And how long have you been in solo practice with your wife?
So we're very new to this. We've been going for just over 7 months now. And we started thinking about it probably this time last year.
Okay.
And we were both working in jobs that we enjoyed, both working for fantastic companies here in Newbury. And we just went for our evening walk as we usually do. And I'd had someone say to me that day, "Oh, I don't suppose you could be my lawyer." And that's happened before. And because we've worked for companies, we've always had to turn them down. If you're an in-house lawyer, you can't work for someone else. And I was sort of talking to Sandra, my wife, about that and thinking, I would really have loved the chance of supporting them. And we came back from this walk thinking, well, why don't we start a law firm? And it went really from there quite rapidly. We started working out what a firm would need to deliver financially. We started looking at a business plan to see if we thought we could meet those financial expectations. And it hit us within a week or so that, yes, we were reasonably confident if we couldn't do it, we could at least give it a good shot. And so the question quickly became, well, are we going to do it or not? And we went away and we spoke to some people, and some very wonderful people gave strong signals that they'd use us if we did open our own law firm. So we decided, yeah, that's what we were going to do. And we started looking at the regulatory framework and what we'd need to do to get authorised as a law firm with a solicitor's regulation authority. And it didn't look as daunting as we'd feared. There was a lot of paperwork, but we did it. And they accepted us, they authorized us, and there we were. We had a law firm.
Now, did you have to make a decision as to how you were going to structure the business of your practice, whether it's a partnership or what we would call here a limited liability corporation? Or do you have choices there in the UK as to the business structure?
Yes, and we went for a limited company. It's a limited company that's regulated as a law firm. We could have gone for a partnership, but we wanted the additional protection that being directors of a limited company would bring.
Sure. Now, and I have to commend you or at least note the fact that you chose as your partner in this limited corporation to practice with your wife. Tell me, it's bold, I think, in some respects. Tell me how that worked out for you, or is working for you.
So what I'd say is 99% of the time, it is the best decision we could have made. And 1% of the time, it is the worst decision we could have made. And we love working together. We complement each other very well in terms of skills. Our interests are sufficiently aligned in terms of our practice areas to make this work as a firm, but different enough that we can cover slightly different things.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're not clones of each other. You have different skill sets, and you apply them to slightly different client sets. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Sandra's background is in pharmaceutical and healthcare law, with a sort of a strong tendency towards commercial agreements and contractual work. My strength is really in the technology, internet and communication space, bringing a mix of the simple technology knowledge with legal and policy work, bringing that together. And to a company, we'd like to think as a client, that brings a reasonably strong skill set, covering their commercial operations through to their privacy, data protection needs, regulatory engagement, product design and development, all from the same two people.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a very nice fit. So all joking aside, what has been your biggest challenge to date in operating your new practice?
I think our biggest challenge is something we need to keep working on, frankly, and that's work-life balance. And I'm sure that this is something which almost every business owner will have had on their mind at some point. And perhaps we feel it more than most because we're husband and wife. We work from home rather than from offices. But we do notice that we have an awful lot of business-related conversations sort of whenever they crop up, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, weekend, holiday, whatever. And I think so far it hasn't been a problem, but I think we're going to have to get better at trying to have a distinctly separate personal life from our office life.
Yeah, and I think you in your particular situation, there are added factors here which help to create an environment where it kind of blurs the line between professional and personal, because A, you're working with your spouse, and B, your office, and we'll get into this a little bit further, but you work out of your home.
Yes.
And so there's really no physical or actual boundaries to help you separate personal versus professional. So that's all that does sound like it will be a challenge.
It's something that when we started off planning, and we did go through a quite methodical process of planning this firm, it was one of the first things that we wrote down was how would we make sure this happened. And as we look back at those list of sort of initial risks, it is one that we know we still need to work on.
Right. So you're gonna have to carve out time or space, you know, a no work zone kind of thing. When you step outside of this door, We can't discuss business, or past this time on the clock, we can't discuss business.
We certainly need to find something like that.
Yeah. Or when I'm wearing this blue shirt, I don't want to talk about business. You know, it's something along those lines.
It's going to have to be something simple and pragmatic. And the reality is, with the clients that we have, actually, we end up working sort of various hours of the day and night, depending on what's going on.
Right.
So finding something that's going to work, we're fortunate, I think, that we're busier than we projected. It does mean that the hours we're working are longer than we planned. And if something comes up that we think the other would have a useful input in, we'll turn to them and go and have a chat to them about it. And that's brilliant in so many respects. But at the same time, finding that separation, that still needs work.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what your setup is like, your home office, how you manage to leverage technology to support that environment.
Day to day, we work mostly from home. Sandra's in one room, I'm in another. And most of our interactions with clients are either on the phone or via video or by email. Although every so often we do travel to meet people, and I'm certainly a big proponent of meeting people and seeing them face to face where that's necessary. But a lot of clients want to keep down the cost, keep down the traveling time. So we do a lot of things remotely. I think For me, the favourite thing about my office is a standing desk. It's cheap. It's a fold-away table from IKEA that I've just bolted higher up on the wall than I think was designed for. And I have a 27-inch monitor sitting above that. It's just such a brilliant alternative to sitting at a desk all day. And I'll quite happily stand at my desk most of the day. I tend to sit down when I'm on the phone for some reason, but when I'm writing advice or researching something, I'll tend to be standing up, working at the standing desk. And I finish the day feeling far less tired and feeling far fresher than a day that I've spent sitting down. And for me, that was money very, very well worth spent.
And there's plenty of literature out there that to not just suggest, but to show that standing while working or long periods of standing is actually much healthier for you than long periods of sitting. So you're on the right track with that.
Certainly seems to increase my focus. I find that I get things done faster and more precisely if I'm standing than if I'm sitting. And I don't know why, because the IT behind it is almost identical and the work I'm doing can be much the same. But hey, I'm not going to query it. It works for me, so I'll carry on going.
You know, there's a thing here about folks having a treadmill desk as well.
Wow.
Now, I have a just as an aside, I have something, I think it's called, I don't remember what it Surf Shelf? I think it might be called Surf Shelf, which is a hard plastic arrangement that actually straps onto the front of the treadmill. So on occasion, I actually can take my laptop downstairs and put it on the Surf Shelf, and I can actually walk on the treadmill and do some work. Certainly can't go much beyond a certain speed, otherwise my writing gets a little suspect. But yeah, there's some folks that are doing that as well. Did I understand from our earlier conversation that you're mostly an Apple product based office?
Yes, we're pretty much an all Mac or iOS law firm. We use MacBook Airs as the main devices connected to external screens. We each use iPads. I'm currently very much enjoying writing on the new iPad Pro, taking notes on that. That's almost completely replaced paper for me. I'm looking up at the servers sitting in the corner of the study now. Two of them are Mac servers, and there's some Linux machines sitting over there as well, which does our telephony. So yes, we're very strongly Unix based, whether that's mostly Mac and some Linux machines in there too.
Now, I know from our interactions on Twitter and some other platforms that you very much are aware of and concerned with security, particularly using cloud services.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
I think we've given a fair amount to the security and resiliency of the machines that we use in running the law firm, and frankly, in terms of business continuity more generally. I'm not hugely trusting about storing data on other people's computers, particularly when it comes to client data or more sensitive information. And some of the clients that I have really take security very seriously indeed and would expect their suppliers to do the same. So we work on a simple basis that every machine that we use, be that an iPad, a tablet, or a phone, or laptop, or server, everything is full disk encrypted and capable of remote wipe. Sure. So if someone should break in either to the servers in a data center or take the backup machines from the house or whatever, there should be very little capability to remove anything from it. The machines may have some scrap value, but hardware can be replaced. The data should be protected. We take email security seriously. We offer all our email are digitally signed. And for clients who will support that, which is an increasing number, we encrypt our email on a routine basis. Frankly, whether there's sensitive data in there or not, just to keep that consistency of security across what we do.
And how does that work from your end, setting up an encrypted email communication system?
So we use the OpenGPG standard, which is fully interoperable with PGP. So we have the software that integrates with Mail, the standard Apple Mail app on the desktop. We've generated our public and private keys. And by default, all outgoing email gets signed. That's just a setting within Mac GPG. And for clients who have given us their private key or we've been able to look it up on a key server, it will automatically encrypt our email to them as well.
And so once that's done, there's no other settings, there's nothing else that you have to do to ensure the encryption of the communications, correct?
Other than making sure that the icon is ticked for encryption when you go to send the email, nothing else to do.
And that icon is in Apple Mail?
Yeah, that comes. It's an add-on that comes in, but it's very visible on the face of an email near where you'd put an attachment onto an email. There's one button that shows signed, one that shows encrypted.
I see. Interesting. And now, do you use a practice management software package of any type?
Yes, we're using Daylight.
Oh, you are using Daylight. Oh, terrific. Yeah. And how do you find that to work for you?
Pretty good. We're happy with it. There are a couple of bits that we've never managed to get working properly, the contacts and calendar, the DAV-based synchronization, and full credit to Daylight for attempting to troubleshoot it. But we came to a mutual conclusion that for whatever reason, it was not working. So for now, we've had to leave that to one side.
Okay.
But otherwise, we've been very happy with the Daylight experience.
And that's an area I was able to make that work in my case. And I operationally separate, you know, my personal contacts and personal calendar from the professional calendar. But I do have Daylight integrate the contacts and calendar with the Apple contacts and Apple calendar so that I can go to one place to look for it. And it's spread out over all my devices. But I can understand that would be a frustrating difficulty if you weren't able to get that to work properly.
What we've ended up doing, and I think part of the problem came down to Daylight support view at least, was that Daylight tends to run on a machine that's sitting on the same physical network as the clients.
Right.
And Daylight for us runs on our main server, which is sitting in a data center somewhere away from us, different physical network, and to which our home has a sort of direct access through the firewall and the data center. I can't see a reason technically why there should be a problem, but for whatever reason, the traffic wasn't flowing the way it should. So we ended up moving away from that. Instead, we're just running the OSX server calendaring and address book servers running directly on that server, and that seems to be doing the trick fine. So we've still got the separation between our personal contacts and calendaring store and our work ones, but we've ended up using the Apple server software rather than the Daylight.
And then on Daylight, you're using that for the cases, the linking of notes and what have you. Okay, that sounds great. What's the best tech tool that or the most efficient, most useful one that you have or that you find yourself using?
Perhaps a bit of a trite answer, but the short answer is whatever I happen to have at the hand, to hand at the time that I need it. One thing I really value is if I need something, I can pick up any device and the files that I need are there. So if I'm away traveling and someone calls needing something, I can look at Daylight on my phone. There are all the documents and there are all the emails for what I'm working on. If I need to draft something, I'll still end up reaching for my MacBook Air. And for whatever reason, that's become a really favored piece of computing kit to me. But the short answer is I want whatever I've got to be able to do what I need when I need it.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the beauties of the Apple ecosystem is that once you have it set up, you have everything on every device, and it's transparent as to which one you use. So,
yes, and where we had a particular challenge is largely down to me, my refusal to use iCloud or any third-party cloud software for that synchronization. So wherever something needs to appear on multiple devices, the onus is back onto me to find some way of making that happen through something hosted on one of our own servers to make that work.
Sure. All right, well, let's chat for a couple minutes here now a little bit about how you go about getting clients. I think I understand that when you opened your practice, you were lucky enough to have a few folks come along with you or decide that they would work with you. Since then, what have you done or what are you doing to attract new clients to your firm?
You're absolutely right. We were in a very fortunate position, particularly from lawyers who came working for companies rather than working for other law firms, that when we started, there were people already knocking on the door saying, are you ready yet? Can we start? So we did start with some clients there ready for us. In terms of marketing since then, it's been almost exclusively passive. Our clients have either been those with whom we've worked previously and who've moved to different companies and wanted to continue to use us, or it's been through networking or through word of mouth recommendations.
So primarily it's a referral-based marketing system thus far?
Yes.
And you haven't done anything explicitly to go out and solicit new referral sources. You're still working sources from your previous jobs and related.
We haven't spent any money on advertising or Google AdWords or anything like that to date. We do have a website. It's on both the web and it's on Tor to appeal to sort of a broad range of potential clients, but it's not something we've gone out and pushed at people. We're experimenting a bit in quite near future, sponsoring some tech events and meetups to try and raise brand awareness with groups who could be potential clients of ours. But that really came out of wanting to support those events rather than thinking of it initially, at least, as a marketing activity.
Sure. And you're really wired into the technology space, so that makes perfect sense to do that.
It's going to be interesting, as with quite a lot of what we do. It will be on quite a measured basis. We'll start off with a sort of pot that we're happy to almost invest, and we'll track, see what comes back from those events and see whether that's something that's worth spending money on in the future. But we're in a reasonably fortunate position that we're almost as busy as we could take. And so while we want to ensure that there's a pipeline there and there are constantly clients who do want our services, at the moment we've had to start turning clients away. So it wouldn't be a sensible economy to start spending money on advertising if we're simply going to end up turning away those who do then try and come through the door.
Well, it's a nice problem to have at this point.
The only people who are criticizing it are my PhD supervisors, who I think must be wondering whether they're ever going to see any work from me again. But yes, otherwise it's a lovely problem to have.
So, as I understand it, you're also, if you don't have enough on your plate, you're also going for your doctorate.
Yes, that's right.
All right, so you're a busy guy. Now, in terms of being busy, I think I understand as well that you do some speaking engagements as well.
I write and speak really quite a lot. I teach in the UK quite a lot. I teach a 2-day course on communications regulation in Washington, D.C. every year. I've taught master's degree courses in contract and telecoms law in Africa. And I try and write a fair amount for computer law-related publications, both in the UK and internationally as well, just to keep up with what's going on in the state of the art, and because I find it enjoyable.
Tell me how those speaking engagements came about.
Ooh, that will be going back some time. I think I started off by simply writing to people and saying, I'd be interested in speaking at your event. This is the kind of thing that I think might be of interest to your audience. How about it? And once you've spoken at 2 or 3 events, I found the invitations tend to come through quite regularly after that. So interesting. Now, I probably turn down more events than I agree to speak at, and I try and pick those which either look where I can deliver the most value, where it will be the most use to the kind of clients that we're hoping to get for the law firm, or those which simply look the most interesting.
Now, are you cross-promoting that kind of activity on your website and on social media channels as well?
To an extent. I've done a little through the law firm, but quite a lot of my speaking activity's goes back several years now and happened well before the firm did. So some I cross-brand, some I don't.
Right.
From a regulatory perspective, we have to be very clear what we're providing as a law firm and what we're not providing as a law firm. So I try and keep that a reasonably bright line and make a conscious decision when I'm going to do something as the firm. Otherwise, it's just me in a personal capacity.
Interesting. Well, you're going to have to let me know the next time you're in Washington, D.C. I'm located just outside. I'd love to come listen. I used to, in my previous life, work in the telecommunications arena. So that would be great for me to touch base with you there. So listen, Neil, this has been terrific. I do appreciate you taking the time. You know, it's a little later there than it is here. So you probably have dinner to look forward to and spending time with your lovely wife. So we're going to let you go and tell our audience where they can learn more about you and how they might reach you if they have an interest in doing so.
Our website is decodedlegal.com. Email addresses, phone numbers, whatever you might like are on there. Please do get in contact.
Okay, terrific. Well, we'll put that in the show notes. And we'll have this episode up pretty shortly. And once again, Neil, I want to thank you ever so much for taking the time to be on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you very much, Neil. Thoroughly enjoyed it.